Hello.
Hello.
I'm Grace.
I'm Madeline.
And we're Dragon Babies.
Dragon Babies.
We reread our favorite YA fantasy classics and discuss why they may be even better for adults.
Yes.
This week, Westmark by Lloyd Alexander. Is it a fantasy novel? We'll discuss. It is classified as such as YA fantasy.
That is a good point. Yeah. I actually didn't think about it until you said that.
That's something we're going to need to get into.
Yeah.
And it won't be one of those things I mentioned at the beginning of an episode and say, we'll talk about that later. And then we never talk about it.
Grace editing later.
Just
face palming.
Like, oh, God. Really need to keep mid-episode notes. Anyway, this book was published in 1981, and it is the first in the Westmark trilogy. It was followed by The Kestrel in 1982, and then The Beggar Queen in 1984. And this book, Westmark, won the National Book Award for Children's Books in 1982. So it did get some acclaim at the time, which I'm always excited about the noobs. I'm excited about a National Book Award. I want the books that I love to get their day in the sun. And I have long considered this to be the ultimate fantasy action comfort read. It reminds me a lot of some Tamara Pierce books, especially the earlier Alana books. It goes down so easy. It's a page turner. You can't put it down. There's little mysteries woven in. And a hot guy that everyone's obsessed with.
Hot guy.
There's wacky characters. There's intriguing characters. There's so many really frightening villains who are driven by their greed or their own ego and desire for power.
Yeah.
It has it all. We do thoroughly spoil every book that we cover, so if you haven't read this one before or in a while, scamper along, check it out. It is weirdly a little hard to find for a Lloyd Alexander book. I would think that his would be more prominent on the internet at this point.
Yeah.
But I was very easily able to get an old library copy on thriftbooks.com. You will see that the school library did put the barcode directly over the title on our Instagram. Always disappointing, but you know, I also have the mission of wanting to make library books more visible on Instagram because a lot of the books on Bookstagram are brand new, right from the bookstore, the most recent edition. And I do love seeing the weird old versions. And this one is actually from a school library in central Illinois, which is where our mom was born. Madeline, would you like to break down how the publisher chose to package and promote both this library edition, which has the first edition cover, as well as the one that I owned as a young wee reader?
Yeah, so I guess on both covers, it's Florian, not Theo.
I think that has to be the case. We're having a little bit of a debate here. Please look at our website, dragonbabiespodcast.com, where we'll have both these covers up as a part of the episode. The covers really follow a similar template, although they are very different art styles, and one has many more characters in it. But it shows a group of people that are important to the plot, sort of midst action. But both feature one dashing man
who has much confidence
shirt
in his posture
and a giant pistol in his hand. And I propose that this has to be Florian, not Theo, especially because Florian is a little bit older than Theo, and we know that Theo is still like an older teen pretty much,
and he has like a gun aversion as well,
and he doesn't like guns,
versus this man is very comfortable
with his pistol. On the first edition cover
he is like very sultry looking.
Yeah,
like his shirt is opened to his belt. He's like posing, like slouching back, and he's got his pistol pointed up in the air.
Our mom was here and she saw it and was like, oh, well, that looks like adult fantasy. It was like, an open shirt doesn't necessarily mean
it's
that.
It's really not. No,
it's,
you know,
just flowing.
I think it's because you can't see his nipples.
Yes, nipples would be absolutely outrageous. They have been censored.
But yeah, I really like both of these covers. I think the original one is my favorite because you have this man who's posing, who I've already described, and then behind him you have the Count doing an absolute... He looks like a funny character in a Zelda game.
Just making a potato face yes. and rising up out of the front man's shoulder with a feathered cap on.
With a huge purple feather that's like curling up over it. And then behind him is definitely Mickle. Looking like a consumption victim.
She doesn't look good.
No, she doesn't look healthy. I just noticed that the Count is also clutching his little elixir.
He has one of his huckster bottles yeah. with him, which is wonderful.
Yeah, but I like the composition of it a lot. It's cool because her like cloak kind of like swoops down and around to create the border of the image. And then you have some like thatched houses.
Right. We get the city feel, slightly more recent than medieval setting. I feel like this book is set in the 18th century in France, ? I mean,
yeah, because they have just versions
of France and versions of the 18th century.
Yeah.
And it has a very French Revolution vibe to mm-hmm. it throughout.
Yeah.
And the other cover... This is the copy that I had in paperback when I was 13.
And it really looks like clearly like the same man and just like draw this in your style by a different artist.
I know. It's kind of great.
Yeah. Same pistol. His hair is lighter, but same flowing shirt and confident.
Although he is
pose.
Covered.
Yes. His shirt is closed at the neck.
Pecs are covered.
Yeah. And then you have Mickle behind him, the Count behind Mickle, and then...
Musket.
I really love that Musket's cloak is, like, swooshing at, like, a kind of continuum
of
the W.
He looks like a bullfighter. Oh, yeah. No, you're right. There's a continuation of that line, the W in Westmark.
It almost looks like it got snagged on that point, and he's, like, yanking it off.
Oh, my God. I love that. Yes.
Yeah, but yeah, he's, like, brilliant red cloak, and then around the corner is like a looking guy who's probably like part of the guard.
I was thinking that was actually the chief minister. I mean, those are very fancy guard outfits, but yeah, the chief minister also wouldn't have on that type of...
Yeah, it sounds like he wears like evil minister clothes.
As one does. He shops at evil minister shop.
Yeah. But yeah, both pretty exciting covers. Both of them are intriguing. They look exciting. Hot man.
We're on board.
Yeah.
I do. Yeah, there is something funny that I think kind of fits with a lot of different Lloyd Alexander books where I think they're kind of packaged as straightforward fantasy when they then are so complex mm-hmm. and go into such deep themes. Mm-hmm. And the question of like how the monarchy functions in this book is very interesting. And we actually get viewpoints from like every conceivable perspective mm-hmm. and people who like were peasants but now have risen within the monarchy to then someone who was a nobleman and now is leading a revolution against it, like lots of class shifting mm-hmm. and very complicated. But you look at this cover and you're like, guns, fight, red cape, feathered hat.
Yeah.
Yes. Get me in there.
Yeah. Good covers. Definitely good covers.
I will now attempt to give us a plot summary. This is a quick book and it goes at a nice clip.
Mm-hmm.
I also really liked that it was still divided into four parts.
Even though it's pretty short.
It was so compact. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed the experience of reading it.
It's very easy to read.
We enter Westmark, which is a nation that I couldn't help be reminded of the Del Toro Quest books.
Everything will remind you of them now. Now you're like me.
I'm just a little Del Toro head, where we have a king who is being, as well as a Theoden effect, of course, we have a king who is being led
further.
Yeah, we got a
worm tongue analog.
Right. He's being led further into mental unwellness by his main advisor, who just snuck his way next to his side and won't go away and is obsessed with trying to get the king to name him as his heir. I loved this. I thought it was so bold.
Just running around like, adopt me, daddy.
Also made me think of Graceling, which we covered on the Babetreon recently. There's a ruler in place. The ruler's not actually ruling. There's a creepy advisor who's sliding his way in there. But in the other books, someone tries, you know, the creepy advisor tries to, like, put their own other, like, reasonable heir apparent up there instead.
Yeah.
Here, the advisor just like, I really want to be your son.
I'm king now.
And King Augustine is like, I don't really know what's happening because my daughter died 6 years ago and she's all that I can think about. So all he wants to do is call for spirit speakers and the like to come and try to reach his daughter in the other world.
Yeah.
So that he can talk to her because she's
pretty deep in it.
They don't talk about what they think even happened to her. She just disappeared.
Yeah.
So the king and his queen, Caroline, and the court physician, Dr. Torrance, love that a doctor got to have such an important role in this book, are trying to, the king is not well. The queen and Dr. Torrance are trying to help bring him back to reality a little bit. But meanwhile, the minister, Cabarrus, that's his name, is just bringing in more and more of these frauds who say they can talk to his daughter. So each person he has an audience with makes him go deeper into the messed up void that he's residing in. And things are just getting worse and worse. Throughout, Cabarrus is extending his reach and his network and is more and more becoming the shadow king of Westmark.
And he's doing all kinds of bad stuff.
He really is. We meet Theo, who is an orphan. He lives in a small town and is the apprentice to a printer named Anton. They have, it seems like the town's one press. I mean, I would assume that given the other things we learn about Westmark, there's probably one printing press per small town.
Yeah.
It's not that robust a market yet. And one day, a weird guy, a traveler, comes in and asks them to do an incredible amount of work that will cost them a small fortune. These pamphlets for someone named Dr. Absalom, who is touting his miracle cures and his ability to do literally anything.
Man, they were definitely going to rip them off, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is really funny.
Yeah.
Once you realize that Dr. Absalom is actually the Count Las Bombas. Did you notice that all of his pseudonyms were anagrams?
No, I didn't.
Hey, that was fun. And he and his right-hand man, Musket, are traveling through town and country and everywhere that they can get to, just putting up their little sneaky stunts and conning people out of as much money as possible. So in some towns, he does the, like, miracle worker act. Mm-hmm. In others, he pretends that he is a nobleman and just kind of through the guise of same classitude manages to get, like, lodging and money out of people mm-hmm. who believe that they'll be paid at the end of his stay. Instead, he skips town. He's got a lot of different schemes.
It occurs to me that Musket is not a, like, dwarf in the fantasy race sense.
Bingo.
But rather just a man with dwarfism.
Yes, that's correct. Which also makes it feel more like a standard fantasy book.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have... Also, I didn't understand why they kept calling Theo a devil at first. So at first I was like, oh, does he have like cute little red horns and a tail? Like, is...
I wish. That would be amazing.
I guess now I understand it's like a job.
For like an apprentice.
Yeah.
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 Yes. But I wish that were so.
All right.
Theo and Anton, his boss, are trying to do the job when some court soldiers come and say, what are you doing? We have to inspect all printing presses. And it's clear that they're trying to avoid any kind of even minor uprising. Mm-hmm. So they see the job that they're doing, all the crazy Dr. Absalom stuff, and they're like, this is illegal, and start destroying the press. And there is a fight. Theo thinks that he accidentally kills a soldier by hitting him with a piece of the press. And then he and Anton split up in town trying to get away, and Anton is shot and killed.
Yeah.
And Theo's told by a soldier who is compassionate to him and has, it seems, known him his whole life that he needs to get out of town immediately.
Yeah.
And he's being declared a bandit of the first degree.
Yeah, he basically convinces him that it's not a good idea to go to the cops on this one.
Yeah. There's a lot of good ACAB stuff throughout this book, actually. Yes. So Theo leaves town and comes across Musket, who brought the order to their printing press, the one that got them in so much trouble, and his boss, Count Las Bombas, who is a flamboyant con artist.
He's a flim-flam man.
He's a flim-flam man, that's right. Theo ends up working with them because he sort of accidentally shows that he can play along with their little games and act as, I think he is presenting as like a man from Brazil who's like out of his mind, and then a different made-up kingdom. And then they give him elixir and he calms down.
Is that kingdom real to in their universe?
I don't know.
Terenzia or something like that?
I don't know.
I can't tell. That's another thing that makes it feel like a fantasy book.
Right. But then they also mention Brazil. Also mention Rome at one point.
Yeah.
Roman Empire. Anyway, he joins up with them because he doesn't really know what else to do. And then they, during another display for a small town, end up being kind of tricked by an urchin, an irrepressible urchin named Mickle, who throws her voice so that it seems like what they call their, what do they call the head?
But she doesn't even tell them she's doing, like, she just does it during the act, and they're all just like, oh.
Yeah, they have a wooden head, a sort of dummy head that they use in some of their performances, and Mickle hides and throws her voice to the dummy head and makes it talk back to them and make fun of them and roast them during a performance, and the crowd loves it and they give them all their money. Then Mickle comes out and is like, you gotta hire me now because look at how well you did, which is an amazing way to get a job.
Yeah.
Recommend it to anyone. So she then did they... The Count decides, with help from the accidental help from Theo, he immediately feels a fondness for Mickle and wants to help her and take care of her. I think because he's an orphan too, and he knows how hard it is in this world. And she says that she's been living in Miss Blah Blah Blah's school for girls, which sounds like a truly horrible place.
Yeah.
She also made me think of Dido Twite from Black Hearts and Battersea by Joan Aiken. We have episodes on a couple of the books from the Wolves Chronicle series. Definitely check those out if you like Westmark, because I felt like there was a lot of shared DNA. But as I said, I love a irrepressible urchin. So Mikkel joins them, and Theo and the Count decide that she's going to be an oracle priestess, and they will put her on display, and she'll claim that she's speaking to spirits by throwing her voice, and they rig up a ghostly figure that they kind of pull around on pulleys. I mean, it sounds great. To me, the funniest thing about Countless Pombas and his performances are that half the time, I don't think people are actually being tricked. I think they're just willing to pay for this spectacle.
Yeah, it's entertainment.
So there actually is, like, once he moves away from the Elixir of Life stuff, which, of course, I have huge problems with, and that type of snake oil persists. It's well alive and well today, with the help of the internet. But once he switches over to doing the more esoteric spirit world stuff, I'm like, so they're just putting on plays,
right?
Yeah. And I think people are pretty clear on that for the most part.
Yeah.
But poor Theo is continuing to have misgivings. He didn't want Mikkel to ever be put on display or taken advantage of, and he feels that this is still doing so. So he's feeling uncomfortable along the way. Theo, in general, is just not happy with the way things are going, and he's feeling morally twisty.
Yeah, he gets so guilty about it.
Yeah, he feels very guilty about tricking people and taking their money. And so another reason why he can't be the guy on the covers. Like, it's just not his vibe.
No, yeah.
He leaves. He runs away without saying anything to anyone, and goes to a different town and meets a man named Florian, who is the hot guy we've been talking about, who is quietly leading a revolution with a band of merry revolutionaries.
He's organizing.
With his very loyal followers, who the ones he is closest to, he refers to as my children. And there, Theo becomes a letter writer. He meets with people in town who can't read or write and are trying to get a message to someone. So then he has a broadening of his horizons, because he's mostly learning about everyone else's woes and misfortunes. And he says to himself that his actually weren't that bad. There's a line that's like, Theo had thought himself to have more than a fair share of struggle, but he realized he actually had almost none. At that point, one of Florian's devotees, who Theo is, he's involved with all of them just on a social level. He doesn't share the same anti-monarchy sentiments that they do, and he's trying to kind of understand what it all means.
Yeah.
And also he's just on a, you know, lower level of the hierarchy of needs. He's just trying to, like, survive, and he lives in a garret and writes letters all day, and is still very scared of being caught by the Kingsmen. But he hears from one of Florian's followers that in another nearby town — I keep saying in a nearby town, but there's, like, a lot of different
there's
little places.
There's a lot
places
of little towns, yeah.
I don't remember their names, and I didn't write them down. He finds out that Musket, Mikkel, and Las Bombas have all been arrested, and Las Bombas is being kept in a cage in the town square because he said he could escape from the cage. And then they were like, okay, let's see you do it. And I think took away, like, his little tool or whatever he was going to use.
Because he, like, laughed or something, and they saw it
and
in
they
his
saw
mouth.
It in his mouth. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And they're like, okay, now really escape.
Yeah.
So Theo immediately is like, I have to go and help them. And he decides that he will set out for this town to do so. And Florian's like, we'll come with you, and we're going to storm the guards' garrison and steal all of their weapons, because we need weapons for the revolution. Mm-hmm. Which, as you can imagine, makes Theo feel conflicted. There's also a simultaneous action happening where two children that live in this horrible swamp called the Fingers,
the Fingers,
are like performing their nightly combing of the swamp to like find dead bodies that they can loot to try to get some kind of money.
Yep, yep.
And they find the body of Dr. Torrens, the court physician. They at first presume him dead, but then realize he is still with them, and they bring him to their hut where they have another political, a wanted political prisoner, who is a man named Keller, who had a revolutionary comic newsletter that he would publish that was mocking the chief minister and the monarchy.
Yeah, and like everyone knows, all the learned people know who he is.
No, I know. I love that. He was like the political cartoonist.
Yeah.
I also thought it was funny that he clearly took pains to disguise himself in his comics, because he created this figure for himself that was like an old man.
Yeah.
It was like old Kestrel and the Bear or something
Kestrel.
Like that.
Yeah.
It was Kestrel, right? Because that's the name of the second book.
I think
Kestrel.
So. Oh, okay.
But as soon as everyone sees him, they're like, hey, it's you. Like, well, I guess it wasn't that much of a disguise. Or he's just well-connected. Who knows? So it becomes clear that there are all these little fingers in the fingers of people who are reaching out. They're in hiding. They're avoiding the Sauron's eye of the chief minister. But at the same time, they're working on gathering their forces. So conflict is looming sooner rather than later. Theo and Florian and all of his band go to the nearby town to break out the Count and Mickle and Musket. But when they get there, they are able to save them. There is some conflict. Theo can't bring himself to shoot a guard, and his friend almost dies because of it. They get away, but then in an inn shortly afterward, the Count sees a man who tricked them on the way out of town a while back.
And he can't resist.
And he can't resist going after him and being like, you scoundrel. And then the guy's like, I'm actually employed by the chief minister.
And I'm looking for you.
And I've been looking for you guys. We've had some hints of this. I haven't mentioned the chapters that have the chief minister's perspective because they're very chilling and dark. But he's been sending out his feelers to try to find them. And he's remarkably interested in Mickle, more so than Theo and the Count. So at this point, they are all brought back to the palace. There they meet the chief minister, and he tells them that he will be forcing them to perform and do their Oracle Priestess act. But Mickle is to tell the king that he needs to let her go.
And adopt me.
And he needs to adopt Kavaris as his son. And Kavaris says, you look just like his daughter, and you're about the same age that she would be at this point. So that plus your trickery act is going to do everything that I need. He's meeting with them in his creepy torture dungeon, which hilariously is now defunct because the king ordered it be taken apart, but he still uses it for his meetings because there's like, it smells like blood, and there's an old trap door that they used to put bodies down that led to the river.
It's just a body disposal. I was gonna say it's like a oubliette, but it's really not. It's just a well that goes into running water that you put things you don't want around anymore into.
For sure. And while Mickle's in that room, she is seemingly reverting to a younger state and is also clearly experiencing PTSD.
She's having a bad time.
She's curled up in a ball. She's not really able to communicate. She doesn't like the hole in the floor and is just generally freaking out. So the watchful reader will note that there's a connection here.
I knew it as soon as she showed up. Sorry, go
ahead. It's okay. Mickle. They go to the performance, and in advance, they have had a, they were given a moment to scheme by Kat Riss when he's like, I'm leaving, I'll be back in a bit.
That was a bad call.
And I was like, really?
Yeah.
These known fiends and con artists.
Yeah, just gonna let them chat
by themselves. And they do talk and they do come up with a plan, which is for Mickle to tell the king that the chief minister is actually evil and that he needs to get him out of the court. But when it's time, Mickle instead begins acting out her memory of the time when she was a child and she was thrown into that well by Capris, because it's her. She's the missing princess.
Yeah.
Princess Augustine? Oh, Augusta.
Yeah.
There's too many Augusts.
Roman names.
She is Princess Augusta, the long-lost princess, and as soon as she begins acting this out, and she's doing it with all of her amazing talents, she's throwing her voice, she can do perfect mimicry of different characters, so she's using the chief minister's voice.
It's really a nice way to just kind of
it was
tie
amazing.
Everything together.
It was amazing. I was like, if this isn't narratively satisfying, I don't know what is, to seed all these little pieces throughout the book. And then you get to have it pay off in a performance that all of the upper court is also witness to.
I thought it was really good.
It was great. And so immediately the reader, this reader, is satisfied, because I was like, there's no way that we're going to have to put up with any of the nonsense of like, they don't believe them. They believe the chief minister, like the king's too far gone. Immediately the king and queen are like, that's our daughter. She's alive and you tried to kill her. And Cabris tries to escape. He and Theo have a dramatic showdown hanging from the bells, the Juliana bells, which the king had silenced when his daughter died because they were her favorite thing in the world. But as soon as they hang from the bells ring out again and they awake Mickle, who had fallen into a sort of trauma coma and also had a fever and just not doing well at that point. And she wakes up and Theo saves the count, or sorry, not the count, the chief minister from falling to his death, because he's like, that's not what I choose to do with my abilities. I can't end a life.
I would have let him go.
Instead, the chief minister and his assistant, who is just characterized as looking like a dog.
What's his name? His name's really funny.
Yeah, I can't remember. And behaving like a dog, they are exiled to a desert island where the joke is that they can figure out who's going to rule each other. And everybody else comes back together. And Theo is in love with Mickle. She's in love with him. They have a very, like, young sort of, you know.
Yeah, how old are they?
We just want to embrace. I think they're, like, 18.
Oh, okay.
Or
that's
maybe
not
a
that
little
yet.
bit younger. I mean, this is just based on my best guesses. She's still a child when she disappears, and it's been more than 6 years.
Yeah. I guess now that she's a princess, that probably is all that they can do.
What do you mean?
In terms of physical intimacy.
Oh, okay. Well, they seem happy with that. They really love each other and want to take care of each other. And Theo is employed by the doctor, who is now the new chief minister, and he is taking a very different approach to being a part of the ruling class, and he wants to travel throughout the kingdom and talk to the regular people and see what they want, what they need. And he wants Theo to do that. That's my imitation of like a homey politician.
Okay.
And he wants to do that with Theo. So the two of them are going to head out and do that. Theo was the one who insisted that Cabris not be killed. I feel like that's going to come back.
Yeah, I
can't help but feel it.
Pretty bad
call. I haven't
call.
Read the other books, but I do think that was a bad call. And at the end, when Theo is balking at leaving and leaving Princess Augusta Mickle behind, she says, "You find what you need, I will find you."
Yeah, it's a cute line.
It's a great ending.
Yeah.
And that's Westmark. Old and new impressions?
I had not read this book.
Thank you.
Great read. It was so easy to read. You know, when there's no audiobook, I get a little nervous about like staying focused on it and finishing it. It was so fast, though.
This is truly like a big mug of tea read where it's like you sit down for an hour and a half and you're done.
And you can just get through it. And it's like very it just keeps at such a fast clip. There's really no faff, like there's no padding,
but you still get all these really glorious little character and world building details. I think it's kind of a masterclass in like that kind of story.
Which is really nice. And I like that, you know, because there's lots of points of peril in it, but I like that. Because I get frustrated in books when the peril just gets dragged out and it's just like, oh my God, like you're making me so anxious. Like, just tell me what the thing is that happens already. So I like that, you know, there was decisive action and forward momentum. I liked the characters a lot. I was so into when suddenly it just throws at your feet the reformer versus revolutionary debate. I was like so stoked about that. And I'm curious how it like works out in this universe.
Totally.
I have a feeling they're probably gonna hybrid it, and that's probably part of why it's a fantasy. because I can see, especially if the last book is called The Beggar Queen, I'm anticipating that like the monarchy does like become something different. Which I haven't historically heard of that happening in our reality. But so like I'm interested to see,
but this is Westmark.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm interested to see how that turns out in the book. But I think it's like an incredibly relevant debate now. And there's hardly any revolutionaries, which to me is like a huge bummer. But at least like seeing the discussion being had was exciting. Because that's just like not something that happens. I thought that Florian was a super interesting character. I definitely would have killed Cabarrus. It's not a good idea to let the fascist like wander off into the woods to like find a new fascism.
but it's more because Theo is thinking of himself than thinking of Cabarrus, because he doesn't know how to live with being a killer.
I think it makes a lot of sense with Theo's character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very true to him.
Yeah.
That's just like me being like, come on, Theo. But it like that was definitely in line with what he believed and what he would have done. I thought he was an interesting character. And I guess it's kind of emblematic of the fact that he's not on the cover of the books because he like supports other characters' journeys. And he still has a very like, you know, he has a hero's journey of some kind, but for some reason a lot of the time he feels more like a supportive character as opposed to the main character.
Well, he's also interesting because he is not, his quest is truly just self-growth.
Yeah.
And then the protection of Mikkel, but he also can't even really articulate that super well. I mean, his primary objective is just to avoid getting arrested. and I mean, that is a challenging objective, to be sure, especially after he takes up with the Count.
Yeah.
And then he ultimately is heading directly into situations where he is way, way, way more likely to get arrested in the pursuit of saving his friends.
Yeah.
I think and it's mentioned multiple times that he's never left Dorning, the little town that he lives in.
Okay.
And I think that Lloyd Alexander is playing off of his kind of inability to ever even have access to thinking about something bigger and broader.
Okay.
And the way that he continues to hone and use his same skill set of being able to read and write in the aid of like distributing material and also helping prevent the eradication of like educational tools that the chief minister is interested in. Because it seems to go far beyond stamping out printing presses that are creating propaganda. I think it's just anything that's encouraging free thought.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, he's a hardcore fascist.
Yeah. And so I thought Theo was really interesting in that regard. And he also, I mean, one of my favorite characters ever is from another Lloyd Alexander book, The Black Cauldron, and is Adeon, who is the great, he's cool character. Viewed as a great warrior, but all he wants to do is go home to his farm and his beloved.
He doesn't get to.
And then he dies.
So sad. Spoilers for The Black Cauldron.
And Taryn is looking to him as this hero who he wants to model himself after. And Adeon says to him, like, what you see and imagine as great about war is just, it's so wrong.
Yeah.
It just couldn't be further from the truth.
And it's, it is like how they, you know, it's been used for thousands and thousands of years as a way to get young people to go die in war.
Yes. Yeah. the glamour of it and the concept of heroism being attached to going into battle.
Yeah.
Something that I found really interesting that I hadn't really thought about before I looked. So I was curious, first of all, I saw that some critics had attributed the exploration of some sort of French existentialist themes in this book to Lloyd Alexander having translated a few works by Sartre when he was younger.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, huh, I didn't know that. Also, how does he speak, you know, fluid French? And I learned that he was sent to France during World War II. He was in the army. He was too clumsy with artillery to be sent to the front.
Good move.
And the
good
sight,
move, my man.
And the sight of blood made him faint. So he couldn't work as a medic. He then briefly played the cymbals
in the war.
In the band, like in a military band. Then he was transferred and served as a chaplain's assistant. And throughout his time, he was able to study at Lafayette College, which is in Pennsylvania, which is where he grew up. And that's when he got really into like studying the French language. Okay. This was after the World War II. So he had this really fascinating experience of being like so close to war, but like truly not involved as an individual.
Yeah, no.
It's... And stuff like that. Also, I don't know. I need to dig deeper into this. I'm very curious about how much of that was like pure natural inability and how much was intent.
Yeah, I mean, World War II front lines in
you're not
France.
Coming back. yeah, you're not coming
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
Yeah, so after that was when he was working as a French translator, and he was at the University of Paris and started meeting some French poets and whatnot. And that is also how he met his wife, who he was then married to for like 61 years until he died. So he found great joy from his time in France. Anyway, I think all of that is to say that it informs my understanding of his love of these characters that are really concerned with violence in books that could be sweeping fantasy epics. But instead, there's a pretty constant discussion of what is being lost when lives are lost, also paired with questions of what the forces that are fighting mean and what they actually stand for, and like, hey, should we actually be supporting the figure that we are like killing others to support right now. You know, no matter which like quote unquote side, like good or evil, they might fall on. And I think that's one thing that I just really love about Lloyd Alexander in general. It's always more complex than you think.
No, yeah. I was like, once we started getting into that stuff, like I said, I was like, cool. All right, Lloyd Alexander.
Totally. I love the way it's written too. It's so like, if we do look at Theo's hero's journey as him just like being the hero of himself, like just trying to accomplish that self-development, he, you know, gets into all this muck and mess, starts to like have strong feelings about things for the first time in his life, then he steps away from all that by leaving Mickle and the Count and Musket, and he goes to this place where he is just like steeped in, it's like he went to college, it's like he's steeped in all these radical ideas, and he's like
learning critical
getting
thinking,
getting close with the common man, and like going to lots of late night talk sessions, and there's one guy who's obsessed with poetry, like won't stop saying it.
Sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, it felt very reminiscent of that to me. And then very quickly he's there for 2 months, and there are times when he kind of like thinks back fondly to it, living in a garret. There was a great line about the garret that was like the resident who was choking to death on the heat in the summer could be comforted by the thought that in just a few short months they would be freezing. And I was like, hey, I've lived in places like that.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing how it seems to work.
The other thing I was going to say is Mickle. I don't know if it's just because I'm well versed in a lot of tropes and types of plot points and like how the narrative puts characters in, but for some reason as soon as Mickle showed up I was like, she's the missing princess.
That's really funny. I mean, just to, I haven't really mentioned my old impressions, but I don't remember the book super well, but I think it was also because I would always read it in that sort of slurp style that we were just talking about. That's probably why I was thinking about tea, because it's just like yum 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 yum. That's how we read. And especially, we've like been talking about some just reading. I know the whole podcast is about reading nostalgia, but I mean like the literal physical memory, the physical memory and experience of the way that we would read when we were the age that we were when we were first encountering these books. And it just took me back so hard to being like scrunched into a hard corner with, you know, like one elbow on the ground and my chin on my fist for like 2 hours.
Yeah, I used to be able to read like that.
I know, it's so nuts.
Now it's like torture.
Body says
after 15 minutes.
I need like 3 different pillows in order to like put in some serious.
You should see my gaming
time.
Setup.
We have a hideous chair that I won't let anyone get rid of because it's my comfortable reading chair. It's just how these things go. And the experience of reading this just, I savored it so much when I was young. It had every element that I wanted out of a book. It had like the hot, cool hero guy. It had a relatable main character who was trying to figure his stuff out. It had the mysterious urchin princess. And as I reeled off my urchin list earlier, you can tell
you were ready to go.
I think it also stems from an obsession with Charles Dickens from a young age. I'm just weird. As everyone listening,
what?
Knows.
Come on,
top urchins, quick! Don't think about it. Just list.
Just go.
I was the other night. I couldn't stop singing Consider Yourself from Oliver,
oh my God.
Which is probably also a formative urchin experience for me.
I still get those songs stuck in my head too, and I wasn't even in the play. I just saw it like 4 times. I think I saw it every time y'all put it on.
Because my middle school had mounted it, and I was in the orchestra.
I was captivated.
And Madeline had a costume that you decided was like your Oliver costume, do you remember? For like the madam from the brothel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course.
It was amazing.
I still love clothes like that.
Oh, yeah. No. Is this a Dickensian brothel or is this Madeline's wardrobe? I don't fashion. Know. So this book just like tickled so many wonderful little fancies for me. And I felt it doing the same thing again. And the way that you can just speed through and be like, amazing adventure story. Love the characters. God, the goofball that is the Count as well. I thought a lot about how fun this would be as a movie, like an actual hand animated film. That would be so amazing.
That
but
would
also,
be pretty fun.
Okay, and this is the next thing we would talk about. When I was a kid, I didn't question that this was fantasy. But if you think back, what is the fantasy element other than if you think that Musket is of the fantasy race dwarves? Nothing. There isn't. And in some books, we, you know, fiddle with the boundaries. I don't know why I'm doing this with my fingers so much. We fiddle with the boundaries by looking at the religion that's featured in the book and
as,
ways
like,
that it
fantasy.
Could be fantasy. There's no religion
there's
in
really
this
no
book
religion
either.
In this, yeah.
No mention.
Yeah.
He, nothing. There's no priest.
There's like
no
a.
No one says God.
Perhaps
a church.
Very vaguely coded Christian morality, but it's also like a very universal morality.
Yeah.
It's not like a, you know, so I don't even know if that really overlaps or just has that in common that is like good is good and bad is bad.
It's sort of just the type of fake parallel world historical fiction,
yeah,
that takes on a fantasy feel.
And there is like so many things that you would find in a fantasy book, mm-hmm. like so many, mm-hmm. but then the actual magic aspect is not there.
Yeah, no. Everything is explained.
Yeah.
There's like,
he's not a devil.
There's great care. Theo is not a devil. There's great care to also lay out the way that the scam plays are performed, mm-hmm. just to like make it absolutely clear there is no magic nope. involved. Everyone is being tricked.
It's
here's
just
a pulley.
Subterfuge.
Here's a floating limb.
Yep.
Like when Theo first meets the Count, he sees a pile of limbs on the ground. Like I was like, that's for my work. And Theo's like, you're a doctor? He's like, I'm a man of science, which he says again and again. It is so funny. He is such a good huckster because yeah. he also really believes that he is good.
Yeah.
And that's like, he's really the true villain of this story. Even after he's locked in the cage and starves for a while, he maintains, and in the middle of town, so he's also, I assume, being jeered at and
yep.
poked and whatnot.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, well, I've had a full change of heart. I walk the virtuous path now. It's a lonely one. Just so amazing. Not just being like, I'm good now, but also no one else is good. It's just me. Oh my God. I love the Count.
And then he immediately loses his reward money at the end to a different scammer.
He gets scammed right away. And the fact that we see him get scammed multiple times in the book.
So funny.
It's chef's kiss. Yeah. I love Lloyd Alexander so much. I can really appreciate his writing style much more now as well. And he has a tendency for these like cutting short lines, but they're so meaningful. And like we said, I loved the line at the end when Mickle tells Theo to go and he find what he needs and she will find him.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so many good little remarks like that between the characters. So I guess I am calling it fantasy because it creates a fantasy world for me.
Because it is a, like, you know, it does feel like a fantasy world.
It also is very
down
steampunky
to.
In a way
yeah.
that lends it more of a fantasy feel because there's such a focus on guns at a time when, yeah, there were guns, but were they like this readily accessible and prominent in like small towns and stuff?
I don't know. I don't know where's much about
Fritz.
Where's
our gun expert?
Yeah, we don't got one of those around.
We very intentionally don't have a gun expert nearby. Yeah, so very curious to hear all of y'all's thought. What makes this a fantasy book? Because I do feel that it is.
It feels like a fantasy book.
I can't quite define it. And I think it goes beyond just the trappings of a stereotypical fantasy book. And everyone's really anti-war, which I'm just always going to be behind. Animals just like animals in this book. Not a lot. A horse?
Yeah, there's the horse.
There's the horse that pulls the cart. Really not much else going on. So shall we go on to pretend food?
Yeah, I think we should. There's not anything to talk about there.
I will. Oh, actually, let's do a little romantic realism.
Oh, sure.
I do like Mikkel and Theo as a couple. As I said earlier, I also like that they do have that sort of chaste young love thing going on that's just like, I love you. I love you.
Yeah.
It's like embracing and walking around in the garden.
It's
while,
very Victorian.
Yes. While Mikkel's handmaidens are like, that's enough. This isn't okay.
Stop being near each other.
And the way that they feel protective of one another is something that I really liked. And because they are, I mean, I guess Mikkel technically isn't an orphan, but something that's important for us to mention that we haven't is that she had forgotten her former life.
Yeah.
To the extent that only when she would have this one specific dream where she was playing hide and seek with her parents would she ever have anything that she could recall from mm-hmm. that period. Yeah. And it was, and then that would become horribly traumatic, the dream, because that was when she fell into the trapdoor and Cabarrus shoved her down into the well.
Yeah.
That scene is so disturbing. So I think, you know, I hope these crazy kids can make it. And I don't know if we'll cover them for the pod. Maybe we will, but I'm just giving us some leeway here since we love to say we'll definitely finish this series then like 10 years later. Like,
well, that did not happen.
Although later this month, we're finishing the Trickster series by Dameron Pierce. So stay tuned.
It's just two books, though.
Madeline? Okay. Let's get into Pretend Food.
Pretend Food.
There is a lot of hunger in this book. We've been doing a lot of questing books lately, a lot of things that, you know, we're never really going to get a good feast, leading us to decide we really need to cover another Brian Jakes book soon.
Oh, yeah.
When Mikkel is talking about the horrible home she lives in, or that she used to live in, that she escaped from, she said, in the home, they mostly gave us repentance and oatmeal, so I never learned to read or write. I do love oatmeal. I doubt that oatmeal was very good. And later in the book, when Mikkel is princess, she says that one of her first duties is going to be reforming the school. But specifically, she says she needs to talk to them about their oatmeal recipe because something was going terribly wrong.
Which is funny.
There's lots of taverns that they end up in, pubs that they're, you know, traveling through trying to con someone into letting them in. But we don't get a lot of mention of specifics about anything they eat, which also, you know, I understand this book. As we said, it's Spartan. It moves right along. There simply isn't room for descriptions of succulent treats. And to that I say, well, why not?
That is true. There's just like not, yeah.
It's just really not talked about. Oh, there is one. Okay, it's not specifically about food, but I do need to mention it. It's about the comforts of noble life. When Florian and Theo are traveling to get to the town where they're going to spring his former companions out of jail, Theo asks why the area is so beautiful, and Florian says the nobility have their summer estates and hunting lodges hereabout, and a few rustic cottages with all the comforts the rustics themselves never see. Mm-hmm. It amuses the nobles to play at being peasants. I wonder if they'd be equally amused if the peasants took it into their heads to play at being nobles.
Revolution.
Good stuff. Really good stuff. This is why Florian has his children. Everyone's like, oh, Florian. You're so subversive. You see how it really is. And yeah, that's kind of, I mean, sadly, there's not, I just marked like quotes I liked, but there isn't really that much in terms of specific foods. Give my greetings to Jelly Neck. Tell him I shall miss those concoctions he fancifully calls stew. There's a lot of mention of food being bad.
Yeah.
But not too much going on beyond that. But this book had some really good laughs in it. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. Okay, wait, one more thing. I mark this because this supports it being a fantasy book. I can't tell if Musket's being serious or not when he says he bought me from the beggar factory. And then he talks about the beggar factory and he says, you've never wondered why there's so many beggars? Oh, there's no shortage of first-rate paupers, lame, halt, and blind. But half your noseless or legless or hunchbacked, they've been custom-tailored for the trade. Youngsters bought or stolen, then broken past mending, sliced up, squeezed into jars to make them grow crooked, sold off to a master who pockets whatever charity's thrown at them. That's horrible. It can't be true. Can't be, said Musket, but it is.
And why is that fantasy?
Because it is so far outside the realm of what you would see in a natural world.
I do think that I've it's like
messed up whimsy that's running through it.
No, totally. But I've definitely heard of that happening.
But not... It's
of like
not...
purposefully disabling children.
Oh.
So that they can be
no.
beggars and then like get more money that they funnel to like the...
Of course. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the beggar factory. Like
okay.
It being
you're right.
This
it is like an extra like whimsical
It's an
step.
Extra level of absurdity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like making it into its own institute, essentially.
Kind of like Terry Pratchett.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Discworld-esque. Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
We've already decided it's fantasy.
Well, I'm just giving some supporting evidence. All right. Let's do our baddest ladies.
I think I'm going to give mine to Theo.
Yeah.
And I'm going to rate him freedom to continue to develop himself and his place in the world.
That's really nice. I'd love for him to like get a little like a writer's retreat because I feel like we're heading in the direction of him actually becoming a writer
yeah.
himself mm-hmm. rather than just a like scribe and printer
right.
for others
to
thoughts.
Do his own words.
Yeah, and maybe not in the horrible Garrett apartment, but like in town with Florian and his friends, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great.
Yeah.
I'm choosing Mickle, aka Princess Augusta. Urchins. They got me.
Urchins, man.
My rating for her is a bowl of oatmeal that I have prepared. I have been having overnight oats and chia seeds every day.
I just bought some chia seeds because I want
to
do that.
Oh my God,
too.
It's so good. Put in some Dutch cocoa, some maple syrup, a little bit of salt because you need a little saltiness with it. And then you let it all, you know, sit in its container overnight. Have it with some berries. Baby, you got a stew going. This is so good. Carl Weathers.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. We'll probably put butter in it.
Well, it's all cold because it's overnight oats.
Whole milk.
Yeah. I use whole milk.
I just don't like maple syrup. Just put some extra sugar in there.
You guys can't see the face I'm making.
I have dino oats. I wonder if it would work with dino oats. Those are quite sweet.
Madeline just looked so disenchanted by everything I was saying. And then I find out it's just because I said, put in a little maple syrup. You can use anything. Sweet. Doesn't have to be maple syrup. Okay. Let's wrap up. Thank you so much for listening. That does it for Westmark by Lloyd Alexander. This was really fun. A lot of listeners have mentioned Westmark over the years, so not shouting anyone specific out. Sorry, guys, but we see you, we love you, we appreciate you. You can see everything that we mentioned in this episode on our website, dragonbabiespodcast.com, and on our Instagram and now TikTok at dragonbabiespodcast.
Check out also my Instagram and TikTok, Pig and Doodles. It's where I post my art and stuff. That's Pig, as in my dog's name, the letter N, Doodles.
Nice. Yeah. Next up, we'll be on Trickster's Queen by Tamara Pierce.
Yay,
Coming out in a couple weeks. And this month on the Babetreon, which you can join for just $3 a month to get an extra episode, we will be covering Sunshine by Robin McKinley. Very excited about that as well.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/dragonbabies. Check it out.
Yeah.
I'm Grace.
And I'm Madeline.
Until next time.
Goodbye.